So in your last job, what was your reflex time?
At the volunteer department or at something you called about?
At the island one, the one that had a 100.
With the volunteer
staff?
We had a 4-minute reflex time, and we had a between an 8 and 12 minute response time depending on where on the island it was. The island is 34 square miles, 36 square miles, the same size as Manhattan. And so from one station to the far beaches, it would take us a bit of time to get there. But from an all-volunteer staff, if I wasn't on island, it took about 4 minutes from tap out to get to the station, get in your rig and out the door to on scene between 8 and 12 minutes.
So they weren't based at the station?
And our standard was that if you were going POV, which was discouraged, so if you're in your personal vehicle, my standard and expectation was is that if the call was between your house or where you are in the station, you stop at the call and we'll bring the resources so you get on scene. Now what that does for the report card is I don't have that time because they're not on the radio and they're not communicating with dispatch. So I know if I had a POV response person that they were getting definitive care or start care earlier that isn't captured in that data. It's just that piece of data analysis, and you can say, here's where it is. And I try to make a comment about that if I could in the reports, but I can't give you a number because it's because
But it was an all volunteer, there was no paid staff.
That is correct.
And what did you find, since you managed volunteer in the larger workforce as well as this, what did you find for volunteer participation? Did you struggle to get volunteers?
No, and the reason we didn't struggle to get volunteers is one, we were all hazard. So the opportunities for the volunteers to come on board and be engaged covered everything. So they were exposed to rope rescue, to trench if they were interested, all the hazmat stuff, all the EMS side. Because it was Tualatin Valley and it has a name, we actually had a waiting list. We would have 75 people apply for a 12-person academy every year because they were using it as a resume builder to get onto a career department. And so of the 23 stations that the district had, 6 of them were combination stations that had volunteers out of them as well as career staff, and 2 of them were volunteer only in one of the West Hills. So the volunteers loved those stations because they actually either had a shifting where they would work at night on the weekends, and they actually ran as a crew. So they got fire experience, EMS experience, because they responded on everything. They loved working out of the downtown Beaverton station because that was the busiest station and they rolled on everything. So I had the opportunity of managing the volunteers is, you guys are managing the rehab squad. So every single fire we have, one of those 2 rehab squads that is 100% staffed by volunteers are going on fire. So that really helps retain.
How about in the island project yet you worked?
So,
did you have
I am
struggle?
Fortunate that I have 35 volunteers out of a permanent residential base of 1,600, which is fantastic. The way that I've been able to maintain the volunteers there, and we have fairly little attrition on Sabi, is we have multiple opportunities. So we have fire that have the full meal deal that can go inside the structure fire. We have some that are exterior only. We have some that do both. We have EMS-only responders because they have no interest in running inside of a burning building, so we give them that opportunity as responders. Because statistically, if you look overall, about 80% of the call volume, 80 to 90% of the call volume is EMS, so we give them that opportunity. We have support volunteers and I have cadets. So what I found was, is we had people that just wanted to start to give to the community that came on as support volunteers that caught the bug. This is cool. And then they went and got EMS training as first responders. And then they kind of liked responding on calls. And then they started, I want to pull some hose. So then they went to exterior. And so what I found was that retention piece, the more flexible you have in opportunities, the higher your retention rate is because they have more opportunities. And then they'll find one piece and morph into the next and morph into the next. Is what I found, at least.
You know, along those lines, that sounds like a very positive argument for bringing EMS under fire. I mean, what other sorts of efficiencies do you see? Administrative, cross-training, the role of the chief?
From a system standpoint, if you bring them all together and you have one person that sets the guidance over all, I think that that gives common vision, common focus, and you don't pit entities against each other that you have to work strategically. So with the private ambulance company, AMR provides transport for Multnomah County. Saabye Island is part of Multnomah County. So when we have an EMS call, our volunteers are rolling, but we get an ambulance that's tapped out from a reflex time, from a system status that immediately starts to the island. We still beat them to the scene. So I think overall, you have chief administrator, so the CEO, since you're really running the business, and then you have two sides of the house that are working collectively. Common training, you get to know each other because you learn and you're working with each other. So where do you get some efficiencies is you don't have two separate HRs, you don't have two separate finance, you don't have two separate pieces. You now start working collectively for commonality. If you don't have it under one roof, I still think you have opportunity to do partnership stuff. So take maintenance, for example. If the fire department is able to provide maintenance for the ambulances, well, then just contract and get it done. If you have people that can repair emergency vehicles, okay, well, then look at that. If it's under one house, you just manage it, right? You can then have one capital replacement plan that covers all of the equipment, whether it's fire apparatus, whether it's EMS, whether it's rope, whatever. So I think that definitely if it's under one house, and that would be minus transport. If you have fire-based EMS that, like Tualatin had with seven ambulances, you're managing the whole thing anyway, right? You just don't have that billing, put the patient in the back. That's the only thing that's missing. So you have common training, common HR, common maintenance, and you plan it.
Right.
So I think that that's an opportunity that you would have if it was under one house.
Okay, and along those lines, you know, we read the numbers that 60%+ of it EMS calls are within the town. Mm-hmm. Would you see a paramedic, EMT, full-time house, let's say, under the fire station, what a scenario? To get those response times where they should be, or are you comfortable with this, the sprint cars they have in the situation?
I would say that without being able to actually look and talk to the people that are doing it, that's a premature statement to say it would. I would say theoretically, that makes sense. I'd want to dig more into actual call volume, how they're being tapped on, because I'm seeing some inefficiencies in how we tap our system anyway. Mm-hmm. And some of that inefficiency, and it's a very difficult piece that needs to be explored more. When you have volunteers, you want to tap them to respond on stuff that they're needed for.
Right?
Right now, we tap them for everything. Whether it's a automatic alarm, whether it's an automatic fire alarm, automatic medical alarm, and everybody go, right? Well, there's some inefficiencies in there. The flip side of that is, if you don't call the volunteers, they're not going to show up on anything, and you reduce retention. So that takes a lot more of understanding. So you've got a lot of members on the EMS and the fire side that live within the town. So is it right to have paramedic and an EMT on the transport unit 24 hours to help that reflex time? Maybe. But the tap goes out at the same time to the volunteers. It may be a next door neighbor. So I can't answer that one because I don't have enough context yet. But anecdotally, it would make sense to be something to explore. I just don't have enough data.
So are you getting a sense, only being here 2 months, of where the fire department's appetite is for this?
Yes. I think that in the short period of time I've been, Mark mentioned that there's some fear in some people's minds. I think that there's some excitement in others. And I think that holistically, I think that where I had the sense before as I was doing my background kind of research for the organization, that there was some reticence at all, that a lot of that is like, I can see where it's beneficial for the community to do something different, and it's going to be a partnership somehow, right? I think that there's some energy with a new guy and some new thoughts. That I think that setting it up right and being sure that you communicate, that I think that people will be on board. I think that there's a little less because it's going to be your part of the process and you're not just going to be told what it's going to be. Because I think that my feeling in talking is we don't want to be told. We want to be part and we want to understand where we're going. And that's what takes a little bit of time to make sure that the people are taken care of, both citizens-wise and the employees, both career and volunteer, are taken care of. And I think that they're seeing that there's an openness and there's a dialogue that people are willing to talk. So I think that my gut sense that the two-month time, which could be completely wrong, and it could be I shook the eight ball and it gave me this answer, I don't think so. I think that they're looking to something and they see that the benefit to the citizens is a change somehow, and they're already working with each other.
Can you see strategies that might work to better engage the boots on the grounds in the process that we're talking about doing that would make for better ownership on both sides?
I do. I think that one is the open dialogue, just mm-hmm. to start with, that here's what we're thinking, here's what mm-hmm. we're exploring, here's what you all have done right now, here's some possibilities. Because I'll give you an example of one thing that I had read early on was, well, if you do this, well, then the hospital district's going to have to shrink to meet the size of the fire district. Why don't you think about it from the opposite standpoint? Why doesn't the fire district grow? I didn't think about that. So then the membership's like, well, how could you do that? Well, if you have, and then you go back to response zones. You define how it is. Now you can start to put some funding into community risk reduction on the outer islands. Now that's benefiting them, and you have some people in-house that want to do more public education. Well, now they're getting to do that. There's another side that says if you grow, both from EMS and fireside, it might be beneficial to have your own fire boat, not a shared law enforcement fire resource. Well, if you bring on some of the outer islands and you're committed to that, well, maybe that funding ties to that. So I think that people are seeing possibilities that they may not have seen before by open dialogue. And you just keep them engaged on both sides. And I think the big part too, and kudos to EMS over recently is, and I understand historically that it was like, ooh, you're fired, you can't get into an EMT class. I will say that that has changed. That, you know, we've got five people right now in the EMT class currently, at least 50% plus are dual trained now over there. So I think that a lot of that sense of culture is changing, which says we can do it together. So yes, there's communication, yes, there's concerns, but I think that how you tee it up with that transparency and communication can really help smooth the way. Is everyone going to be happy? No. But the more you can communicate and listen to them, the better you are in order to support them regardless of where it goes, and the citizens are going to.
It is interesting because that cross-training is happening organically. Mm-hmm. And it's just a natural outcropping of everybody wanting to serve the community, which is kind of the overarching.
Which is the mission of both sides, right?
Right.
Serving the community and the citizens, and then it's our obligation as leaders to take care of our members, like you and everyone else that's part of our organization. That's our job, is to make sure you all are taken care of. Because your job is to make sure our citizens are taken care of. So it's all that holistic team thing. And we're fortunate that we're firefighters, right? Because we think team, unlike some cops.
You know, one of the criticisms a couple of us have heard, and intuitively, I don't believe it and I don't understand it, But it'd be great if organizationally, could you just comment on this issue that keeps cropping up where people are afraid if EMS in any way, shape, or form were to come into the fire department, there would be damage to the training regimen on the medical side of the world. That it's sort of this all or none hypothesis.
And I don't think that's true by any stretch of the imagination. If anything, the skill set and the training will go up for everybody. Because if you're a certified firefighter, you have certain requirements that you need to maintain and do throughout the course of the year. There are certain requirements that you have as a EMT or a paramedic that you have through the course of the year. I've been a dual-trained firefighter-paramedic for 31 years. I have to do all my fire stuff, all my fire officer stuff, and all my paramedic stuff to maintain. So the training plan is to support all of that. So you holistically grow, and so organically, everybody that participates in the training will grow an understanding of the greater piece. The one aspect that's here that needs to be tied into it from a pre-hospital piece is our air transport stuff. Because if you can't manage the person here on the island, it has to go off. So you have to work with all of our agencies. So that means your air agencies have to be worked into the system somehow too, because that's the system, right? So you have to understand how all that works together. I was asking, and you're talking the training specifically. I said, okay, so when are we gonna do an MCI drill with EMS? Because that's a great way to bring everyone together. Mass casualty, you've got to manage the medical side of things, the fire extrication side of things. There, it's a great drill. We can get citizens to come in, we'll moolodge them up, it's gonna be great. But we don't do that. What do you mean you don't do that? We're going to be on the same scene. We're going to be cutting stuff up, and we're going to have firefighters in gear inside the car holding C-spine, and we've got EMS set up over here to do triage transfer. We don't do that. We need to change that right now, and we need to come together and do that, period.
We've done it a couple times.
We've had
one a year.
And it's fun, right?
So it's
you bring
great.
It together. Well, everyone
yeah,
says, well, we do it separately.
ER
because
is involved as well.
Absolutely. See, so I was told no. Obviously, I'm glad to hear that that's not true.
We do MCI every year.
So. You're talking about every 15 minutes, right?
No.
No.
The other one that we do is
We did an active shooter drill at the school. We did a mock, I think it was a plane crash. We did a mock bus crash. We've done
you just
a variety of
things.
Yeah,
one recently. That was
the fire department and EMS did a joint drill.
Those are 15 minutes.
No. It was on a Saturday. No more than 2 months ago. Because I was going to come and I couldn't make it because I was working on Lopez. And the EMTs went from our side. It was a Saturday drill. It was being EMS.
We
also had a ferry drill.
Yeah.
Yes.
There was a ferry drill that happened.
I wouldn't say they're every year, and there can be. I mean, for everything, you can always learn. And I think that those opportunities to train and work together are too far or too few in between. I mean, they just don't happen enough. And you know, there for a while we were having certain EMS crews would come to our vehicle rescue drills and participate in that, but they just, for whatever reason, it just never quite meshed very well, even though we were always on scene together.
Right.
We couldn't get the training to work together for whatever reason, I don't know why, but there have been MCI drills where we've worked a lot of different folks from different agencies into it.
Not that this plays in, I've got some sense as to why it wasn't working, but that's a whole other thing that's not part of this. But to your question, I think that statement, and I read it earlier on in one of the minutes, that's just a fallacy. And it's a different understanding, because I think that holistically, your firefighters will have better knowledge base because you'll be training EMS together, and EMS will have a better context from a training standpoint, but from a standards position, if you're dual trained, you're doing both and you're meeting the continuing ed for both sides.
Yeah, that's always been a frustrating discussion, because it's always it's sort of painted as an all or none proposition.
And that's just not true. You just design it to make sure that you're covering all aspects.
I'd like to build, though, on Chuck's question, if I could, just for a second. And it's probably going to be a 2 or 3 part question, but, you know, the sense of it's been now a separate system, and that fire has been separate from EMS for a significant period of time. It's now being considered into, you know, this, that this consolidation happens. Right now, you know, it's going into the fireside. There's 3 fire commissioners that are pretty, I think, 2 of them, you know, are pretty intense into the fire side of it. And I think, you know, one of them is pretty politically intense. But there's nobody that's medically intense. At least that's my perception. It's great when you buy an ambulance at, you know, $150,000 and you buy a fire truck at $500,000 or $400,000.
That would be a cheap deal.
Yeah.
They got the last one.
We have a coupon.
Yeah.
That's a cheap rig.
So, I mean, you know, yep, the resources seem to go at least be needed to a much greater degree to the fireside, and yet the volume of activity bleeds itself much more to the medical side. How do we, not knowing what outcomes are going to be, people change, board members change, how do we protect the medicine side moving forward? So that's one question with the board that exists today. The second question is, where do you draw the line? Now you're becoming that manager leader of the organization. And if you have emphasis on the fire side and not on the clinical side, and there starts to be a shortcoming to the clinical side, you hope that people will be reasonable and that if that doesn't happen. But if it does, where do you draw the line? How do you ensure that the clinical side, the medicine side, you know, healthcare, I mean, in this, I was just saying, it's changing significantly. And so progressively, you know, another question is, where have you been progressively in medicine? Where do you see things going? So now I'm asking about 4 or 5 different questions. So let me come back to my first 2, because it's a real concern of mine that in what has gone on within this environment and what I perceive has gone on, and that's just my perception. So how do we assure that as we make recommendations and so forth, you're per se not throwing something, you know, from the frying pan into the fire kind of thing, or the other way around?
So yeah, you've got some philosophical questions in there, and then you've got some stuff that really hits to the crux of some of your concerns and the TAG's concerns realistically as you put things together. So I'll start with your first one, and if I miss a point, Rick, you just circle me back. Board makeup. I would say that board, your electeds, set policy and direction. They really don't drive the organization. They don't drive the culture, but they set direction for it. And hopefully, the board listens to the advice that's given by the leadership of the organization. When I say leadership, I'm talking your CEO manager. So if you were to draw it from a private, large company perspective, you've got your CEO and then you've got your board of directors. The board of directors are always looking for the bottom line. They're looking at what's going back to the stockholder, so on and so forth, but it's really that CEO that's driving the business. Yes, we realize that elected boards have more influence than that. What I would say, just looking at it, and this is me personally, nothing to do with current boards or otherwise, I personally think that a 3-person board is too small. The reason why is, if the three of us are on the board, I can't talk to either of you without it being a quorum. I can't ask what Chuck's opinion is or Mark's opinion. I think that's a problem in a complex system. So I would suggest that contemplation of a larger board. Now, you can never earmark, from a political standpoint, because it's all on the electorate, a fire-based or an EMS-based election, right? EMS is currently fortunate that they've got a couple boxes aboard because they won the election. I think, or I would guess, that if we were a system, that you're going to have people that are driven by EMS, they're going to want to run for the board, for a board position. So I would say, how do you protect the medical side of things? You have a good, strong physician advisor that works as part of the system, because from a clinical standpoint, I know fire. I put fire out. I'm a good field clinician from the paramedic side, but I'm not a doctor, right? And I have always worked in great partnership with our physician advisors. Case in point, the current physician advisor in Multnomah County, he and I have worked with, as we call it, our dark days in EMS when we started the private ambulance companies. He has been my physician advisor, and his partner has throughout. And the scope of practice has grown dramatically. I love medicine. And pre-hospital care medicine especially. I taught paramedicine for about 12 years as well. So from the clinician side of things, I like it. I like where we've gone to RSI in the field by standing order, that there's only two things that I need to call in for, because we're doing the clinical side of things that's based on and validated through our physician advisor, make sure we're doing it right. They provide part of the training. Well, that becomes part of that medical protection side of things to the board, because they're making advice and helping drive direction of the organization. That's a partnership piece. You can't control the electorate, but you can control what's being put forward in the budget. You can control how decisions are being made in managing the budget, and you design it that says, here's our call volume, here's where our expenses and needs are, here is what our physician is telling us we need to go for skill set. So if it means we need to have pumps in the field for IVs because we've got a longer transport, and that's what they're recommending for the right level of patient care, and that's where we need to go. If we're looking at things holistically from what best takes care of our citizens, and it means more mobile health care, it means more community paramedicine, well, then that becomes partnership from the chief of the organization, the EMS assistant chief side of the organization, and the physician advisor that says, you need to go down this road and start exploring these things and put funds into it. So while you can't, so your first question is, how do you control the board? You can't, but I think a three-person board's too small in this complex of a system. You should contemplate growing to probably five. I like odd numbers because it breaks ties. And then that's open dialogue between the board and the leadership. Second question that you had is, where do you draw the line between an EMS thing and a fire thing, and push comes to shove? Yes, we realize the fire side, they're more expensive, but in call volume, Island holds true, there's more use on the EMS side of things. So you need to balance that, and that therefore becomes incumbent upon the leadership to manage the budget and make sure that you're taking care of the EMS side of the house. It's a parallel track as far as I'm concerned, and I have never pitted fire against EMS. You look at where the needs are, and you say, okay, the extrication equipment's wearing out, and the 12-lead EKGs are wearing out. Okay, well then we figure out how we take care of both, period. And we manage it with preventative maintenance on both sides. We get into contracts where we can on as much of the equipment as we can. So take the EMS side of things. I know that currently the cardiac monitors need to be replaced. Well, let's figure it out. When Tualatin Valley first went for 12-lead EKGs, I was part of that team. And we bought 45 12-lead EKGs when they were new. Back when they were 25,000 a pop. So that gives you time-wise. And yes, if you listen to my daughter, I've been around since dirt was new. So I was part of that process. At the same time, we bought three new fire engines. But we had to take care of that multi-million dollar purchase of 12 leads because that is the appropriate level of care that we've defined out of a strategic plan that says, here's how you take care of it. So another way that I've always maintained balance, and you look at your strategic goals for the year, I have fire-based ones and EMS-based ones that are independent. So I have an EMS goal organizationally, and I have a fire goal organizationally. So they both have equal weight because the citizens need equal weight. The last one you said is where do I, the pre-hospital future, that is a whole nother kettle. It could go a long ways, but just in a nutshell, I see that if you look at the direction of healthcare in general, and we look at where citizens have become dependent upon ERs, on fire, on EMS to solve everything, there's gonna be more push to the field. I think that there's gonna be a greater, there's already a good one now, I see that there's gonna be a greater relationship between pre-hospital care and hospital care that becomes part of a greater system. That you're gonna have things that are more appropriately taken care of in the field, so they don't have to go into the ER, they don't have to go there, and they're gonna be a gateway system. And they help guide, does it need to go to clinic, does it need to go to ER, does it need to go straight to surgery? And that's a system approach, and don't have all the answers, but you don't know, maybe one day we're gonna be Dr. McCoy, and we're gonna have a little scanner that sends, and then we're gonna have Scotty beam them straight to the ER, and that's gonna fix everything. But until we get to that point, I think we're gonna have a higher commitment and need for pre-hospital care that's part of a greater medical system. And I think that's an exciting time for us to be in. You look back at where EMS came from the 80s-ish, late 70s, 80s-ish time, from the Johnny and Roy, where it was the Bobo drivers throw them in the back of a hearse and go to the hospital. And I would say the Cadillac ambulances back when there were hearses, those were the smooths. Anyway, to where it is today, I think that you saw it come up in pre-hospital care. It's kind of plateaued a little bit, and I think we're right now at a precipice for the next leap on where it's going to go pre-hospital care-wise, because people are more professional, they're higher educated, and it's more working collectively with the doctors and the hospitals to create a system. That's way down the road philosophy, but I think we're at that point where we can contemplate.
Well, it seems relevant to the discussion we're having, though, to have a vision for where pre-hospital care is going if we're going to make any kind of a change to the system.
I think that's where the change is really coming to play, George, really, because fire burns the same and has burnt the same since lightning started. Well, we just manage it because of these polys.
There's less of it, not more of it. And so, in fact, if there's more pre-hospital care going on, then it really does impact the conversation.
You made a really interesting point, because that's the other piece, that if you think about things, fire has done a good job in working to try to put them out of business, which they should, and that is fire prevention. We have an opportunity on the pre-hospital care side-wise, too. Savi, we have fire messages that go out, and we have EMS messages. So we have a time of year that our messages are slip and fall protection. Mm-hmm. It's if you have limited mobility, how can we make your house safer for you? So I think that that is an aspect that hospital, pre-hospital-based organizations from an education standpoint can now start to drive greater safety in your community by having a community risk reduction on the medical side as well, and educating people on how to be safer, slips, and that kind of stuff. And
to be responsive to the community here, I hate to say it, but this is a geriatric community. So that dictates not only the messaging, but the kind of calls you're going to have, mm-hmm. the kind of timing of the things that you need to do to get,
safer. The discussion holds on bringing back the assisted living center that had been mm-hmm. here and went away. Statistically, nationwide, is that for every bed in an assisted living facility, you will increase pre-hospital call volume by one call per bed per year, statistically. Mm-hmm. So it's just something you need to plan ahead for. Mm-hmm. And like you said, as we have an aging population, that's not just here, but the demographics are higher than nationally, that is the trend of where everything's going. People are living longer, so we need to think about that side of the coin as we go forward. And that's all clinical, where do we go, how do we take care of it, and how do we get them into definitive care when needed and keep them in their home because that's where they want to be outside of it. And I think that has a very strong pre-hospital component. Do I have all the answers? Hell no. But it's something to think about from a system perspective.
Well, the choices we make in this group ought to be reflective of whatever that vision might be. So
ponder and suggest there's wide open. And I'm talking way longer than you probably
know. No, I was just going to ask you. I mean,
we're going for overtime on this whole discussion.